Okay, we have a little ground to cover today. We got to Genesis chapter 6, and we got to go all the way through the Bible in 5 weeks. So today we're going to cover the flood to the Exodus, and then we see the other lessons that we'll be covering each week. So you should have your sheet out to follow along with us. There's a few fill-in-the-blanks. There's not many. I have them underlined in the syllabus, so when we get to them, see the great flood. That's your first blank. So put the word flood there. The great flood, God's judgment on the earth for their wickedness. Just a moment, we'll talk about the dispensations and how God gave people a command, and we see how they failed. Then we see the grace of God, how he gave them the opportunity to be brought back. And we see that repeated several times throughout Scripture. So it's an important theme that runs all the way through the Bible. Okay, all animals, men were destroyed except those that were safe in the ark. And, of course, we know the ark is a picture of salvation. And just like salvation is found in Christ and we're saved, they were saved from the destruction of the flood by being in the ark. And we need to be in the ark, Jesus Christ. The unclean animals were saved by twos, male and female. The clean animals saved by sevens. They were all brought into the ark of each species, of each kind, but not every species of dog or cat or cow, but two cows and or seven cows, you know, each one. So it was possible to fit them all on the ark, and the ark was rather large. Noah and his family totaled 8 people, 3 sons and their wives and his wife. 1 Peter 3:20, which sometime were disobedient when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was preparing, wherein few, that is, 8 souls, were saved by or through the water. By the way, just keep in mind, for those that believe in baptismal regeneration, did the water save anybody in the days of the flood? The water didn't save anybody. It destroyed everybody. The ark is what saved them. And baptism doesn't save anybody. Jesus Christ is the one who saves people. 2 Peter 2:5, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the 8th person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly, turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an ensample unto those that after should live ungodly. And we'll mention more about Sodom and Gomorrah in a minute. But if we look at our map, I think we had this last week, so you may not have brought it back with you, but you'll see it here. Here is a Mesopotamia valley, and you see probably the Garden of Eden was somewhere in this area. This is the Persian Gulf. Israel's over here, the Mediterranean Sea, and we're somewhere over there. And so somewhere in that area is where Ararat is at, and that's where the ark landed. Okay, everybody see that? And somewhere in Turkey, in the mountains, and then people evidently migrated back down through this area and settled in this Mesopotamia Valley once again. We look at our chart again, if you have that with you, and I remind you, you can get it laminated at Staples for about $2, which makes a nice thing to keep in your store. But from the time of the flood, we see right here, if we label it according to the chronologies of people being born, it would be somewhere around 1650, 1656. And then we see here is Noah, who his father, notice this, here is Adam. And we see that Lamech was alive for many years during the life of Adam. So Noah's father knew, without a doubt, knew Adam. It'd be presumptuous to think he didn't. So Noah had pretty good knowledge of creation and how the world began, how it all started. And look over here. If you look at Noah's life, you can come all the way down to Abraham, that Abraham could have known Noah. We don't know that he did, but say it's likely that he did. So Abraham could have known Noah. So to follow what people knew in the history of the world, You know, you only have to go through a couple of people to go all the way back to Adam, up to Abraham. So it's just something that's interesting when people say, well, the Bible's a bunch of stories and people have added to them over time and they keep changing them. They don't realize the way Scripture has come to us, how God has preserved it and preserved the truth. Now, we have to say, too, that there's always a good seed and a bad seed, the godly and the ungodly. So back to Adam, we know they destroyed the earth with a flood because the descendants of Cain, and then ultimately some of the descendants from Seth ended up intermarrying, and the world became very wicked, so that everybody did what was right in their own eyes. God destroyed, started over again with Noah. Now, if you get this chart out, we would have just handed this out today. It shows seven dispensations. Out of these seven dispensations, I realize it's kind of hard to read up here, but you should be able to read it. If you're like me, your eyes are a little bit weak, you can get a magnifying glass when you go home, and that will help you. But to get it all on one sheet, we had to print it a little bit small. So here we see the different ages, how God deals, this is an important word, progressively, progressive revelation. It doesn't mean that God gave us a totally different plan of how he would work, but progressively he sort of revealed new things or added to what we already knew. So when he began at the age of innocence here with Adam and Eve, they sinned, then it became the age of conscience, then from the flood, the time of human government. So you see, man was innocent but ignorant. He was intelligent but inexperienced. He was in a state of untested holiness, we might say. But then man failed. So he had the knowledge, was not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but he did eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then we see that man died spiritually, and he began dying physically. He was given a responsibility now that, as a judgment, that he would, by the sweat of his brow, bring forth fruit. So death was on its way. But God's provision, he gave them coats of skin to cover them. To get those coats of skin off of an animal, I'm presuming that the animal had to be killed. You know, he didn't want any animals running around with no skin on them. So I'm sure he had to slay the animal, which is a picture of the grace of God. God took the innocent to cover the sin of the guilty. Now you see this same pattern repeated through every dispensation. So God provided a sacrifice. Salvation requires faith and blood. Faith in the sacrifice and the shedding of blood. And that provided man a covering. And then we see through the age of conscience, the same pattern. Through human government, the same pattern again. And we'll go on from there. But the chart, you could spend a lot of time reading and studying. So mankind failed under the age of conscience. So God started over with Noah's family. Here are the sons of Noah. First of all, there's Shem. Okay, Israel and the Oriental people of the world, the Semites, all descended from the tribe or from the father Shem. They settled the Middle East and the East. And we have basically three major nationalities of people coming from these three sons. For Ham, one of Noah's other sons, came the African descendancy. And from Japheth came the Caucasians that were primarily Europe. And I guess we might add Western Asia to that. So here are the three sons of Noah just starting out. There's just eight people on the face of the earth. But each of them would have children. They would, through sort of being segregated a little bit, kind of go in a different direction. We see that after the Tower of Babel, people confounded their language. People became more distinctive in their characteristics. As an example, those going to Europe became more white, Caucasian in appearance. Those going east became more Oriental, more predominant in their appearance. Those going to Africa became more African in their appearance. So we see where the different nationalities kind of arrive from. So at the Tower of Babel, what we believe happened then is God saw that they were still in that Mesopotamia Valley. People were learning. People were becoming prosperous. And they also, because they were together, were doing things that would spawn evil and wickedness. And one of the things that they conspired to do is they were going to build a tower. Some suggest it's what is called a ziggurat, in like a huge building or tower, not quite like a pyramid, but something you kind of you could climb and go around. But there are remnants of buildings sort of like that, or monuments sort of like that, that are they're the ruins of them. But the idea was they thought they could be more like God, or reach to the heavens, or somehow be more virtuous. So they're going the wrong direction just after a few hundred years. They're seeking to elevate themselves. Now, that's what civilizations do apart from God. You know, they all think that they have the answer, that we're powerful. We're able to find God in and of ourselves. So we see the word Babel. We get the idea they babbled or they confounded the language. It actually means the gate of God. They're thinking they could be, again, like God or in some way similar to God. And you can read this in your notes, but the Tower of Babel is an explanation of the languages spoken on the earth. So when they divided, God confounded their language, they went different directions because they couldn't communicate. And they didn't know how to learn the language. It takes time to do that. So God used that as a judgment. And they scattered all over the earth. So they went far east, they went north, they went south. And as they scattered, they kind of developed their own type of civilization. And again, people became very internal in their offspring, and they looked more and more predominant like what their father would have. So out of the Tower of Babel, and by the way, it's only a brief chapter about the Tower of Babel, but a very important one, because it shows us something about mankind and human nature, that God had to deal with man because he thought he was too big. He was too important. You know, God can bring us down. He can humble us. And in the overall scheme of things, we see God had a plan for man and gave him that opportunity by his grace. So now we see God again, and you see often God calls a man. He uses men, and he called a man, Abraham, to start again with a new dispensation. Okay, turn your Bibles to Genesis 12, Genesis 12 and verse 1. So in the calling of Abraham, it's a very important thing to understand when we go through the Old Testament. Some people just say, well, there's the Old Testament and the New Testament, and they fail to realize the dispensations of the Old Testament, and they see it all together. But the calling of Abraham really is distinctive for the rest of the Old Testament from here on out. It says, now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation. I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. This is called the Abrahamic covenant. It's a very, very important truth and part of history to understand all the rest of the Bible. So the Abrahamic covenant was distinctive. First of all, it is an unconditional covenant. Unconditional covenant. God determined to call out a special people for himself through whom he would bring blessing to all the nations. There are no conditions attached to it, no if clauses, suggesting its fulfillment is dependent, that it's not dependent on man. I don't know if I said that right. But there are no conditions attached to it. So God arbitrarily, sovereignly, if you want to use that word, said, I'm going to call a man, and through his descendants, I am going to bless the people of the earth, and I'll work through his descendants. He could have picked anybody. Arbitrarily, was not conditioned. Abraham had no choice in it. It was not based on his obedience. God said, I'm going to call a man. And so that is the condition. There is no condition to the Abrahamic covenant. Secondly, it's a literal covenant. It's not some mysterious thing. It's a literal covenant which promises should be understood literally. So the land, it should be understood in its literal interpretation. And then it is also an everlasting covenant or an eternal covenant. So the promises that God made to Israel are eternal. So even today, they are God's chosen people. When we hear in the news, people are against Israel, or there's anti-Semitism, which people are against Israel, that's a dangerous thing because you're saying you're against God. That doesn't mean every Jew or every descendant of Jacob is godly or good or right. What it means is, in his covenant, God chose a nation of people, and they are distinctive as God's people. Okay? There are three main features to the Abrahamic covenant. Okay? First of all, there was a promise of land. God called Abraham from the Ur of Chaldees to a land that he would give him. So he starts over near where the Garden of Eden was at, in that Mesopotamia Valley. It's modern-day Iraq. He was there. Still remember, there's no tabernacle, there's no order of priests, there's no temple, there's no Jerusalem, as we would know it. That there's this progression of revelation that God says, all right, now, of all the people on the earth, I'm going to call a man through his descendants. I'm going to bless him, and I'm going to bless the people that bless them, and I'm going to see all the earth blessed because of them. So they needed to have a place to live, and God said, I'm going to give them a land. That was part of that covenant. There was a promise of descendants. So God promised Abraham he would make a great nation out of him, and yet Abraham is 75 years old and childless. It didn't seem possible. So again, we see how God works. What seems impossible is not impossible for God. So God promised him a land, he promised him descendants, and then there's a promise of blessing and redemption. So God promised to bless Abraham and the families of the earth through him. So again, an unconditional covenant. God said, I'm going to do this, this is how I'm going to work. And then Abraham left the Ur of Chaldees, not knowing whither he was going, but God led him to what we know as modern-day Israel today. Now, again, there's, like the Tower of Babel, an episode of God dealing with man to reveal some truths to us. And that is, though God called Abraham and is going to bless Abraham, we see his nephew going in the wrong direction. And we see the evil that was on the earth during that time of his calling. So Abraham remained faithful while his nephew Lot joined the city, pitched his tent toward Sodom, and then went to Sodom and became prominent in Sodom. In Galatians 3, 6 and 7, it says, even as Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness, know you therefore that they which are of faith, the same are the children of Abraham. So from many of these references, as we said last week, and again today we see it, these are repeated in the New Testament, showing us that these were pictures or types, and we see how they are fulfilled in the New Testament through Christ. So we can be the children of Abraham or God's people by faith in Jesus Christ. So we are not Jewish, but in a sense, we are of God's people, just like Abraham was God's chosen nation. So let's list the patriarchs. So God, we start with Abraham, and we call them patriarchs, or their key figures or fathers of a nation. So it goes to Abraham, and it is continued through Isaac, and the promises repeated again through his son Isaac, who was a miracle child, born after his mother was capable of having children. And we see not only a miraculous birth, but there was an episode where Abraham had to be willing to give up his son and offer him as a sacrifice to the Lord. So Abraham had some bad decisions that he had made prior, but for him to do that is one of the most miraculous things and hard to understand truths of the Old Testament. How could he offer his own son on an altar? How could he do that? And it is, of course, a picture of God giving his own son to be crucified on the cross of Calvary. It's beyond our comprehension that he would do that. And, of course, we see that before he could slay his son and offer him, and by the way, he believed that God could raise him up again when he did that. But before he could do it, there was a ram in the thicket, and he sacrificed the lamb. So we see that picture of Christ who took our place. And rather than us being crucified, he took our place and took our sin upon himself. So it pictures Christ crucified. Then the promises are continued through Jacob. So we have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob and his 12 sons were to possess all the land of Canaan. And we know this. There is a story, though, that goes along with that. We see through deceit, through envy, jealousy, the brothers conspired to, and they were going to kill him, and then they sold him into slavery. And so he ends up in Egypt. So Israel is in Egypt. Okay, we're moving right along now. We're going to get through the Bible. So they're in Egypt. And he said to Abraham, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and shall afflict them for 400 years. So this was already told to Abraham. He knew that. And I'm sure this was passed on that they knew it. But there were people living without a close relationship to God, and they forget that. So they sell Joseph into slavery, and Joseph is forgotten. You think they told his dad he was dead. But God had plans. You see, through, again, the grace of God, he provided the salvation of the nation. See, you cannot destroy what God said he'll preserve. You can't destroy the Bible. You can't destroy Israel. You know, you just can't destroy the gospel. Though Christ was crucified, he rose again. He's alive forevermore. So we see God provided salvation for Israel. As my wife said, she'll be teaching on this, God meant it for good. That God had a plan, and so through Joseph, through even their sin, God said, I'm going to, by my grace, preserve you, and did so with Joseph. So Joseph is the most perfect type. And this is a theological term. A type is something that is a picture of a truth. And so if we look at Joseph's life, he's the most perfect picture or type of Christ in the Bible. And we see, you know, he was betrayed by his brethren. You know, he was falsely accused, and, you know, he protected himself against sin. We see different things in his life that are a picture of Christ. So we see salvation through the life of Joseph. So now they are in Egypt. They're not in that land. And God promised them that land. That was part of the Abrahamic covenant. They're in Egypt 400 years. You know, it might lead you to think God doesn't keep his word. If you live during that time in Egypt and a Pharaoh came to power that didn't know Joseph, now they're in slavery, you'd probably start thinking, God doesn't keep his word. You know, he said he would give us a land and we would be a prosperous people, we'd be a blessing, and we're in slavery. But God, in his perfect timing and his plan, delivered the children of Israel. So we have Moses and the Exodus. So Moses, in a miraculous way, was spared by Pharaoh's daughter. They were seeing God blessing the Israelites. They were growing, being prosperous, even though they were in captivity. And so they said, well, we've got to get rid of all the male children. We'll destroy them. That way they won't be so prosperous. And yet they had a plan that backfired on them, because God said, I'm going to raise up a leader, a man. And so God protected Moses and ended up with his own mother, nursed him, took care of him. And yet he learned many of the trades and the education of Egypt. So Moses begins growing up, being prosperous, intelligent, well-trained, and yet he had a love for his own people. He knew who he was. And he saw two men struggling, and he ended up killing an Egyptian, and he ran for his life. So he's about 40 years of age. He goes to the Midian Desert. And there in the Midian Desert, he hides for 40 years. Again, you'd think God's forgotten. God doesn't know what he's doing. But God had a plan. So he's 40 years out in the Midian Desert. He's walking along one day. He's 80 years of age, and he's out here tending the flock probably. And he sees a bush burning, and he's kind of ignores it. That might not be totally unusual, but after maybe an hour or so, he realizes that it's still burning. You know, I've got to go see what this is. And he goes to see what that is. And, of course, God calls him out of the burning bush. And Moses said, how am I going to go back and lead Israel out of Egypt? How can I do that? How can I deliver them? You know, I'm slow of speech. And he had all these excuses, but God said, I'll be with you. And he said, who shall I say sent me? And he said, I am hath sent you. Now, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, but they later interpreted the Old Testament into Greek, and that's called the Septuagint. And that statement in the Septuagint is ego I me, I am. That same phrase is used in the Gospel of John when Jesus said, I am the good shepherd. I am the door. So we see again the identification of the Old Testament enfolded into the New Testament. So God called him. He is the eternal God. And he said, I will help you. So Moses returns with Aaron, his brother, to deliver the children of Israel. And there are 10 plagues that are brought on Egypt to repudiate the gods of Egypt. So all of those plagues that happen were a slap in the face of the Egyptian gods. And God is saying, your gods are no gods at all. They're not powerful at all. There's one true God. Now, another important aspect of the Exodus that we have to remember, one of the things that Moses stated to the Pharaoh, let us go worship God. This is a change. This is different than what they had done before or understood before. When they get to Mount Sinai, God gives them the law. They will be a people of priests and sacrifices, build a tabernacle, and God would communicate through that tabernacle, and that God would meet with them through these priests, and those priests would intercede on behalf of people. This is going to be a new thing. It was not done that way before. Sacrifices had been made. Abraham offered sacrifices. He gave of the spoils a tithe to Melchizedek, who is a picture of Christ. But the order of priest is different, okay? And it's unlike priests today that you might say Episcopal or Catholic priest. They were different entirely than a priest you would think of today. so they would become a people of priests and sacrifices. So there are 10 plagues brought on Egypt. So they're still in captivity, they're in slavery, and in bondage. The last plague is the death of the firstborn. Again, a monumental event, something you have to understand. It is called the Passover lamb. This associates with our Easter season. And the Passover was when the children of Israel would take the lamb, the blood they would put on the doorpost of their home, and that night when the death angel came, if the blood was seen on the doorpost, they were preserved. If there was no blood, then no matter who it was, but the Egyptians did not do this anyway, all the firstborn would die. You know, it's kind of questionable. Does that mean just children, or does it mean even adults that were firstborn? You know, probably it was all the firstborn. Some of them may have been older or firstborn. So there was a cry in Egypt the next day of all these people that lost loved ones. But of the Israelites, they were preserved because they put the blood on the doorpost. And they offered a sacrifice, and they ate the sacrifice, and they were ready to go. This is the beginning of the nation of Israel as we would understand it through the rest of the Old Testament. So they put the blood on the doorpost. The Passover is instituted. They leave Egypt with a high hand. It says they spoiled the Egyptians, which means they took all the things they needed to survive several days, pots and pans and food. There was jewels and gold. They took all those things with them, and they head out probably 2 million, a million and a half, 2.5 million people, and they head out in wagons and animals and all their possessions to a place that's not even prepared yet. No home, nowhere to go. Could you imagine getting ready to go on vacation and the wife says to the husband, "Where are we going?" "I don't know. We'll figure it out. Let's get in the car. We're just going." And that was kind of the plan. God said, "We're going to go out in the wilderness, and you're going to learn how to worship me." Notice that he didn't go to the city to learn how to worship him, but they went out into the wilderness. The greatest lessons of life, the greatest schooling we'll ever achieve, it's usually found in the wilderness. It's found in a place quietly alone with God. So Israel is delivered. They come to the Red Sea. It does say the Red Sea. They came to the Red Sea, and they have mountains on one side. If you could see it on Google Earth, you can do a bird's eye view, and you just come to a barrier. There's no way they could go any further. And so they're stuck. And we know at that point, God is saying, "Just trust me." So they're doing it, but they're very nervous about it. How are we going to do this? And then they start complaining. Moses brought them to the Red Sea. And then we know the story that God parted the water. They went across on dry ground. And then God brought the water back and destroyed the Egyptians that followed them. Now you say, how is that possible? That's humanly impossible. Listen, the whole concept of God is impossible. To believe in God is something beyond man's comprehension. So it's not impossible if we believe in God that God could part the water. And so they went across on dry land. I believe if God wanted to, he could have had them go across the top of the water. Just walk on it like Jesus did. But God said, "I'm going to part the water." And there was a reason. Because they were identified as God's people. They were, just like in baptism, they were buried in the cloud. They went down under and back up to the other side. So the Passover is a picture of salvation. Through the death of the Lord Jesus Christ, through his crucifixion, it begins your life. The Passover began the history of the nation of Israel. They now really came into existence at that point. And that's where they identify their history at that moment, the Passover. They're identified by going through the Red Sea as God's people. They left the world, Egypt, behind, and now they're going to a new land. They're pilgrims on the earth. They're on a journey. Do you ever feel like you're a pilgrim? You don't belong anywhere? Nothing really seems like home? I think that most of us have experienced that. Just, you know, there's a place whose builder and maker is God. Abraham looked for that city. We are looking for that city. So they're identified as God's people. So now we have again, through our dispensational chart, a beginning of God's people, a time of promise through Abraham. So at Mount Sinai, we're eliminating a few things, but they get down to Mount Sinai, and they park there in this huge valley, and a big mountain on either side, particularly on the west side. They settle there, and God calls Moses up to the mountain. And when he goes up to the mountain, God begins speaking to him and giving him what we call the Ten Commandments. And he gives him all the law, how they can worship God as a kingdom of priests. So all that information is given to Moses. He recorded on stone, God recorded on stone, the specific Ten Commandments. And we might add, of all those commandments, the first two hang all the rest. And you see the foundation of law from those Ten Commandments. From every civilized nation, you go back to those Ten Commandments. You know, without the Ten Commandments, we're lawless. The salvation did not come from obeying the Ten Commandments. How did salvation come? From the shedding of blood back in Egypt. From the sacrifice of an innocent lamb. For us, we're not saved by our good works. We're not saved by following commandments. Sometimes people ignorantly say, oh, I believe you become a Christian, you just obey the Ten Commandments. And then ask them the follow-up question, can you name them? They could not even name the Ten Commandments unless they went to my wife's Sunday school class. They could name them if they went. But most of them, they couldn't name the Ten Commandments. And yet they think we have to be... The commandments were a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. But it was a standard of behavior that became the cornerstone of law from then until now. The Pentateuch is the first five books of the Bible. Penta is where we get the word five, and it's also referred to as the law. It's referred to as the law of Moses. So as you go through the Bible, and you see this in the New Testament, it says, is it not written in the law? A young lawyer came to Christ. He was a studier of the Pentateuch. He was a studier of that law. Not an attorney in our sense today, but he studied the law of Moses. Those books are Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So we have the Exodus, the children of Israel learning the law and understanding how they would be an order of priests. They build a tabernacle, and they build the Holy of Holies. They have a high priest, and they go in and they offer sacrifices as an atonement for their sin. So God continued this practice. That's how they learned to worship God. We have a little chart here that gives us sort of a timeline again. So if we go from the flood, the Abrahamic covenant, the children of Jacob's family descendants go down to Egypt. Then Joseph dies, 400 years of slavery. Then they begin the wilderness wanderings. Finally, they enter into Canaan, somewhere around 1400 B.C. Back to our dispensational chart. You might want to bring this each week, maybe both of those dispensational charts. But again, Clarence Larkin's chart is quite interesting. And again, you see the age of innocence, of conscience. Here we have the flood, then the age of human government. And again, the Tower of Babel, a failure. We see the age of promise and calling of Abraham. And as a result of that, the Passover is instituted. And here we see the dispensation of the law, which will bring us through the time of the kings, the judges and the kings and the prophets, up to the point of Christ, and then what we call the church age. And you see all these other things that he kind of adds to it that are very, very important as well. During this time, Satan is the god of this world. And we see what happens to those that are dead during that period of time. And then we'll come back to that chart again.